night, I wrestled my very last match at WrestleMania. I will never, ever wrestle in this ring again. Please, please. I'm not sad about not wrestling. You shouldn't be sad about the fact that you're not going to see me out here. You should rejoice in the fact that I have had the greatest wrestling career in the history of pro wrestling. And last night, even though I lost to a great, great, great wrestler and a better man. Truth. Rejoice in the fact that I have wrestled in front of more fans, raised more hell, had more fun, and loved all of you every day of my life.
All right.
All right. Welcome to the Filthy FRB show for Monday, April 27th. I'm FRB, and of course, joined as always by the filthy one, Tom Lawler. What's going on, Tom?
Not too much. Just hanging out after a big weekend. Obviously, there's a lot of news going on in both the pro wrestling and mixed martial arts world. A lot of rumors floating around about some top-level UFC guys, as well as, you know, there's pro wrestling guys who are – there's also rumors abound about them. You know, we have Daniel Bryan on the shelf, not really sure what's going on with him. And there's a story that's been brewing, but I don't really want to talk about it too much because without having all the facts in place, I kind of like to keep my mouth shut. So, you know, there's a John Jones story, and I know you're the same, Brian. So,
if I don't know the whole story and if I can't speak with objectivity and talk to both sides, I really prefer not to comment on anything like that.
Yeah, I completely understand, and I agree 100%. That's my stance as well. If I don't know every single fact about something, I don't mention it at all. So,
far be it from us to gossip about anything.
Yeah. I mean, neither one of us is known for that. So, you know, we'll just stick with the facts as if we were Tyson Kidd and Cesaro here. Okay. So, speaking of which, you know, last night we had WWE Extreme Rules. We could touch on that later. But even earlier in the week, we had the big UFC 186 show coming from Montreal, Canada, headlined by Demetrius Johnson against, you know, one of your top five favorite fighters, I would say, in Kyoji Horiguchi.
Japanese Fedor.
Yeah. The top fighter. Well, arguably, he is the top fighter coming out of Japan at this point.
You know, but I want to talk about Horiguchi a little bit because the UFC did not promote this guy at all, or they didn't promote this card at all. And I swear, I'm not putting myself over, but I think myself and Super Callow were the only people talking about Horiguchi. And, you know, we know what Super Callow is doing. And I just thought it was funny just to go, you know, for a goof to see if it could gain any traction. And I don't know. Maybe in my little small universe, maybe it made it more interesting to people. I don't know. I mean, going into the card, were you really like, oh, I'm really looking forward to Horiguchi versus Mighty Mouse?
Yeah, I didn't hear too much rumblings on, you know, the internet or really in person. I can gauge a lot of interest on these shows judging on how people are reacting in the gym. You know, if there's a big show coming up, like I'm sure in a few weeks when we have the John Jones versus Anthony Johnson and Chris Weidman versus Vitor Belfort fights coming up at UFC 187, there's going to be a lot of people excited. There's going to be a lot of hoopla at the gym. People are going to be making plans to watch those fights. And this fight, this card did not seem like it had any traction whatsoever. It had no legs to stand on as a pay-per-view. Obviously, it was hurt by the drop of TJ Dillashaw versus Henan Barao due to Dillashaw's injury. But, you know, that's the issue that UFC has been running into as of late with some of these shows, and especially last year, 2014 was a bad year where you had a lot of top players dropping out and basically screwing over the pay-per-view side of things. But they've rebounded nicely this year. I do think that this show will be a stain on the pay-per-view rise in business that they've had this year. But I think they'll bounce back pretty heavily in a few weeks.
Yeah, my other takeaway before we actually get into the fights from UFC 186 in Montreal was the live gate. I saw it was announced at $668,000. It didn't say on MMA Junkie if that was Canadian or if that was USD. So I guess best case we're talking $668 USD. If it was 668 Canadian, I don't have my calculator, but I think that's like 550 or 545 or something like that, and about 10,000 people, which is quite the opposite. I was at UFC 83, the first ever UFC event in Canada. It was at the Bell Center, the same exact arena, and the gate was over $5 million. I mean, granted, it was GSP getting his belt back against Matt Serra. But it really spoke to me like, man, the UFC has killed the territory, to steal a pro wrestling term. It's like the fans in Montreal are just like, they feel like they've been passed over so many times for big fights. And I don't understand it, because I know it's a great city for boxing. They support John Pasquale, Stevenson, the left-hander, and another guy from Romania, Lucian Butte.
Yeah.
I mean, man, they would 22,000 fans. I mean, it's a fight town. And, of course, you know, it's a WWE town too. So if you can't draw Montreal, I mean, there's a problem.
Yeah, well, you know, Brian, bring that up. But, I mean, this show was littered with problems from the get-go. You had Roy McDonald and Hector Lombard, which is one of the featured fights, on this show, you know, dropped out a few months back, and, you know, due to Lombard's positive test, his positive drug test, as well as, you know, they moved McDonald into the main event slot, into a title shot over the summer. So it took a hit there, as well as, you know, TJ Dillashaw dropping out, and then all the entire situation with Rampage. Is he going to fight? Is he not going to fight? Is Steve Bosse going to fight Candy Maldonado? What's going on? So, you know, this show was just all over the place, and by the time that it rolled around, I think a lot of people just kind of cast it off, which is unfortunate in a way, because if you watch the show, there was absolutely nothing bad on it. You know, there were some good fights, a lot of good finishes. I thought Bisping versus Dolloway was a great fight, and, you know, pretty much nothing fell completely flat to me, except for the Rampage and Maldonado fight, but going into it, that's kind of what I expected. So I thought it was overall a good show. You had a lot of Canadian fighters come out looking strong, and you know, that'll help build them up in that market. And hopefully they can get towards making the next GSP in that area. Because like you said, you know, about these shows, I've had the opportunity to fight on two of the Montreal shows at the Bell Center, UFC 113 and UFC 154. And those shows are two of my better memories, even though I lost both fights, because the Canadian fans are absolutely phenomenal. They understand the game. They understand the ground game. They understand the striking aspect. They appreciate the fighters. It's really a cool scene when you're there. And to see half of the Bell Center closed off and, you know, them bringing in a low gate and people leaving during the main event, it's kind of a sad situation. But like I said, I think this will be a, you know, a small black mark on what's been an overall bright year so far for the UFC.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I mean, they have, I mean, started out with Jones and DC, and then Anderson and Nick Diaz, and those pay-per-view, and then of course Ronda, who could forget Ronda, and then that big TV rating that McGregor pulled in Boston, but it's kind of been marred over by outside the cage things. But on the average, pay-per-view wise, yeah, I mean, they've had an excellent first 4 months of the year. But, you know, like I said, out of the cage things and then events like this, I wonder if they're going to start saying, hey, does it make sense financially to run events like this? Because it's not cheap to run the Bell Center on a Saturday night. I mean, it's a major, major arena. And, you know, payroll, even without, you know, huge stars up and down the roster, has got to be close to $1 million. And then all the production that goes into it and getting everybody there and feeding everybody. I mean, there's promotional, you know, money to buy ads and stuff. I mean, I don't know if this thing did 50,000 buys. Did they break even? I know that's a question people have asked me. Hey, what's the break even point? And I heard at one point it used to be like 175,000 pay per view buys, but I mean that's just a number somebody threw out to me that knows a few things, but like it wasn't like they were for sure. So I'm interested to see next year. Are they going to do their typical 13 cards or say, you know what, let's do 10 pay-per-views instead of, you know, doing seven or eight good pay-per-views and then four or five ones that do less than 100,000 buys?
Yeah, I think that they'll continue to actually increase the schedule. You know, to me, like, basically the biggest issue that they've had so far this year, and it hasn't even been really an issue, has been all the outside, you know, the outside stuff that's going on as far as drug tests, drug failures, all the different things that happen outside the cage. And, you know, you would think that in the long run it would do a lot of damage to the UFC and to their buy rate and everything. But if you take a look back through history, there was a time where, you know, baseball was much you know, they had a lot of problems going on. They had gone through a strike. Attendance was down. People just did not want to watch the game. And, you know, lo and behold, the steroid era comes out of nowhere and people are bashing home runs through the roof and people start watching again. The viewership increased and the popularity of the game did so as well. So, you know, you talked a little bit about there's all this other, you know, outside stuff going on in the UFC that's kind of overshadowed maybe some of the pay-per-view buy rates. But, you know, I think I can make a case that these buy rates and the interest in the UFC is actually because of a lot of stuff that's happening outside of the realm of, you know, the actual fights themselves.
I like your baseball reference there, and I know you made another baseball reference before with Candy Maldonado, the Candyman.
I don't even know who the fuck that is.
If I'm not mistaken, he was on one of those World Series champion Toronto Blue Jays teams.
Okay.
Was he?
I don't know. With Joe, I don't even know.
Yeah, Joe Carter, Dave Winfield was on one. Remember, yep. Kelly Gruber, Pat Borders. I used to be obsessed with baseball. I'm remembering all these. Remember Tom Henke?
Yeah.
The closer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was you know, that what was it? Game six, the walk off was a walk off home run by Joe Carter.
Yeah, that was the 93 World Series. He hit that one off Mitch Williams.
Yeah, there we go. That's I remember that very vividly while my Red Sox were scraping the bottom of the division, I'm sure, and then, at that time. So,
and then, like,
you know, we talked a lot about UFC. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and like you said, the next year the strike hit, and it led to a downturn in the popularity of the sport, and then the steroid era brought it back in 98 with McGuire and Sosa.
Yeah, I wonder if, you know, with this increased drug testing that's going to happen over the summer, you know, supposedly everybody's going to be getting random tested and you're subject to this stuff. They've even gone so far, and I've seen this talked about, as having people download an app that will tell you, you know, that will track you via GPS. So they can come find you. I've seen that mentioned. I can't remember exactly where, but so there's a lot of possibilities being thrown out there. But it'll be interesting to me to see if that increases attendance or increases the popularity of the sport, or if it drops off, or if, you know, there's absolutely no correlation whatsoever between, you know, the steroids and these drug scandals and the popularity of the sport.
Now say that again, Tom. They're going to have a GPS that you have to have on. Is that like something WADA does or USADA?
No, I think it's just been talked about. It's something that's been thrown out there by whoever's going to handle this testing scenario. I can't exactly remember where I've seen it reported. So actually, I probably shouldn't have brought it up at all because we don't know if it's fact or fiction. Well, so, you know, but I have seen that mentioned. So.
You know, here's one thing that did come out in the past week or 10 days was these – was some details about the Reebok deal. And I know that you were pretty excited a few months back about the Reebok deal because it was a guaranteed sponsorship. You weren't going to have to send your manager out there and see what he came back with. You knew you were going to get something. And you didn't have to deal with some of these scumbag companies that don't pay you, or if they do pay you, they're months late and you got bills to pay.
Yeah.
And so go over a little bit, if you know offhand. I'm not sure how much you read about it, but there's like four tiers based on seniority.
Yeah, so there's based on the reports, and a lot of this is coming from the Boston Herald, and actually we did receive word from the UFC regarding these tiers. So we don't know the exact payouts, but we do know that instead of it being split up by your ranking, which, you know, it was going to be 1 through 5, 6 through 10, and then 11 through 15 would each be garnering different amounts of money for sponsorship based on their ranking when they fought, it's now based on seniority. So who this really helps out is a lot of the veteran fighters who have been around who aren't fortunate enough to be in this top 15. And you're going to see like the 155 weight class especially. You know, I believe that's the deepest weight class that the UFC has. There's a lot of really tough name guys out there who are not going to be in that top 15, who would be basically getting, you know, the lowest amount of money for sponsorships when it came down to it. So, you know, let me just use I'll use my friend Joe Lozon for an example, right? Who just signed a new 8-fight deal with the UFC, so he's going to be there for the rest of his career. Now he has 18 fights with the UFC. Okay, so he's the tiers now for the people under UFC contract, it's 1 through 5 will get a certain amount of money. And I've seen numbers thrown out there, and you know, it sounds like it'll be around $5,000, somewhere in that range. The next tier will be somewhere around $10,000, and the next tier will be somewhere a little bit more than that. So it's going to go 1 through 5 fights in the UFC will get a certain amount, 6 through 10, 11 through 15, and then 16 through 20. And then 20 plus. So we'll just use Joe Lozon for an example, because I do not believe he's a top 15 fighter right now. And, you know, based on some of his past appearances, you know, he fights really tough guys, but he wins some, he loses some, but everybody knows who he is, right? You know who he is, right, Brian?
Exactly.
You've heard the name, right? And you're going to see other guys like Jim Miller. Okay. He might drop out of that top 10 after his fight a couple weeks ago, but everybody knows who he is. And he's got a bunch of fights in the UFC. So it's fighters like that that are going to end up benefiting in the long run, as far as I'm concerned. The guys who it's going to hurt are guys who are really marketable, who aren't going to be fighting for the title and may not get an exclusive Reebok deal. So I'm expecting, you know, the only people who I think will take a little bit of a hit here in the overall scheme of things are going to be guys like Faber, Rashad Evans, you know, some of the other guys, maybe even like a guy like Junior Dos Santos, who's up at the top of the rankings. But, you know, I don't think Reebok's beating down the door for a piece of Junior Dos Santos. And he may not fight for the title for a while because of the situation with Cain Velasquez already beating the shit out of him a few times. So, you know, it's a guy like that who might end up struggling, whereas pretty much everybody else on the roster is going to be making out better.
Sure. Sure. I mean, and, hopefully,
you know, I've talked for a little bit, for a long time about this, but I'm going to use an analogy here. Yeah. Let me, I'll break it down like this, because this is how it works in my head, right? It's kind of like, and for those of you listening out there, if you've ever been to a nightclub searching for a female for the end of the night, you'd understand this. It's kind of like the Reebok deal. It's like having a girl waiting for you at home. you know where you're going to go, you know what you're going to get. And, you know, if you're happy enough to keep her back at home at the end of the night, it's gonna be a good night. You're gonna get what you want out of it, and you'll benefit. On the flip side, You know, the old sponsorship deal, the old system was kind of like going out to a nightclub. Maybe, you know, one fight you're going to hit it big and score a hot piece of ass. And maybe the next time, you know, you're slumming it and wailing at the end of the night. Yeah. So in one situation, you never know what you're going to get as far as sponsorship goes. And now with Reebok, you do. So I think it's a lot better deal overall for virtually everybody involved. And I'm happy with it for sure.
You know, I heard one media person that I talked to quite a bit brought it up to me about a Brazilian fighter who, when he fights in Brazil, he gets like, I don't know, $30,000 to $35,000 to wear some Brazilian company. They love this guy and they want him to wear whatever their company is. So, but this guy he's not that good. Right, like he's in the United States or in the UFC, he's really not that good. He's, you know, he doesn't have all that many fights, and he's not highly ranked. Mm-hmm. But he gets a ton of money because of Brazilian company. So I wonder how much this will affect some of the Brazilian fighters who were dependent upon Brazilian companies supporting their country, you know, their natives.
Yeah, that's a good point that I hadn't thought about because, you know, the majority of my fights have been here in the UFC and I do deal with United States-based sponsors. But I'm not, you know, those have kind of dried up for the most part, but I'm not sure what the sponsorship deal and situation is in other countries. You know, I know that down in Brazil, they have different TV contracts. I believe they're on what, Globo? Is that the TV station in Brazil?
Yeah, they have Globo and then they have a channel – I think it's called Combate with that subscription, and the color guy on that channel is Anderson Silva's co-manager, George. I won't even say his last name because I'll screw it up. It's George something.
Yeah. Did he say he's a colored fellow? Is that what he said? Or he's a color commentator?
He's a color guy. That's what I mean. He's actually European looking. He's not really okay. Yeah,
I'm just trying to clarify here, Brian. I'm trying to get all the facts straight, buddy. So, I think that deal overall is great, especially for the fighters. All the fighters I've talked to who are veterans think it's a good deal. But I don't know. I haven't talked to many Brazilian fighters simply because I don't think that they want to hear from me. So
maybe you should start a gimmick where you go after Brazilians.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have a friend that's already done that, and he was quite successful with it. I'll blaze my own path, and maybe I'll start picking on guys like Horiguchi, or
don't go do that, man. You don't want to upset Super Kello.
That's true. Or I wouldn't want to piss off Kid Yamamoto either. You know.
Oh man, and you know, actually, getting back to that, it actually got funny because I said that Super Kello and I saved Dave Schaller's job because he failed miserably in promoting Horiguchi. And he didn't like cut like a pipe bomb promo on me, but by the tone of his tweets, I could tell he wasn't too happy.
To me, the biggest factor in that fight, the most exciting thing was the fact that Horiguchi was such a big underdog, because at no point did I really think he was going to win the fight. And after watching the fight, there was no point during the fight that I thought he was going to win. You know, going into it, I thought Johnson was going to be obviously the technically superior fighter, just because he's technically superior to like everybody that he fights. And it's crazy to see somebody so dominant in so many different aspects of the fight game, yet the fans still really don't want to watch him, you know? And I wasn't excited watching the fight, even though I'm watching this guy just put on a clinic. And by the end of it, you know, even though he got the finish, he got the latest finish that the UFC will ever have, unless there's some sort of tie and they go into that extra round. You know, I still wasn't clamoring to see him fight afterwards, and I feel like that's the prevailing sentiment after the show.
But how about this guy Mighty Mouse's luck? You know, he puts on this masterful performance. I believe it was his sixth title defense. And then, what, 18 hours later, the internet is ablaze about a rumor about John Jones. And the news cycle has completely changed. And I don't think anybody even remembers Mighty Mouse fought on Saturday.
No, well, nobody was talking about it going into it. So I'm not surprised that after the fact that they're, you know, nobody's talking about it either. One of the big problems, too, for Mighty Mouse is there's no compelling contenders. You know, after the pay-per-view – during the pay-per-view at the end, they were trying to push Joe Rogan was doing a hard sell on John Dodson as a guy that could contend for the belt again. And, you know, that's a rematch. It's a fight we've already seen. It's a fight that Demetrius Johnson won. And, you know, I don't think that there's any difference if there's a rematch in that fight. And I think as far as Mighty Mouse goes, it could be a situation where either, you know, just based on public perception, he's going to have to move up to 135 to get a big time fight. Or, you know, he might just be waiting for a long time for that title challenger to come along.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that, Tom, and you're right. He's in a division, you know, like Joseph Benavidez. He already beat him twice. He beat Dodson, like you said. It was a split decision, I think, but I think most people thought that was bullshit and that judge didn't know what he was looking at. There is one fight that I really think will get people interested.
Let me guess.
Flyweight. Go ahead.
Henry Cejudo.
Yeah, how'd you know I was going to say that?
Because you're a wrestling mark.
Right. But Henry Cejudo has a compelling story. He's an Olympic gold medalist. He didn't win it with a broken frickin' neck, but he still won an Olympic gold medal for the United States. That means something. And he's got the Mexican heritage.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a story there. This guy could be a big star. You know, he's his own worst enemy. What's that? I was going to say, you know, he's a guy that's been his own worst enemy by not showing up.
How old was he when he won that Olympic medal?
I think he was 19, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was very young. Whatever his age was, he was, you know, definitely low as far as age goes. So, you know, he's got a lot to build on in the future. And to be such a high level at such a young age really spells some good stuff out for the future. The problem that you're going to run into is he's going to be fast-tracked. The guy's only had, what, like 6 or 7 fights?
Yeah, I mean, and then there was like 3 fights that he didn't even show up to the weigh-in for.
Yeah, and if you look at Horiguchi, right, Horiguchi's really young. He's about 24, I believe he's 24 years old. And he got fast-tracked to this title shot because he's not the number one contender. He was ranked, I believe, 7th or 8th, which is about the right spot for him. And maybe given a few more fights, a little bit more maturity, maybe some new tools – maybe he had a better shot against Johnson, but in that division, it's tough when you've already had Johnson basically run through the top guys that he could, and there's just not very many challengers left out there. There's Cejudo as a fresh challenger, and that might excite some people, but other than that, you know, I really don't see anybody coming down the pipeline that could make some money with Demetrius Johnson.
Who is
now? With that being said, it was kind of the same situation with Jose Aldo until McGregor came around. So perhaps we're just waiting for that, you know, that barn burner at 125 who can capture the fans' attention. Although I don't know at that weight class if it'll happen or not.
Who's a guy, Brazilian guy, that was number one in the world a few years ago at 125? He's fighting. He might have a. He's fighting Wilson Hayes. I don't know, even know how to say his name.
You know, is it Juicy Formiga, maybe?
Formiga, that's, yeah. Yep. You think he's got a chance to get to a title shot? Or?
I mean, getting a title shot and beating Demetrius Johnson are two completely different things, you know. And I don't know. I thought Formiga would have gotten the title shot previously. In some instances, because like you said, a few years ago, he was the top guy at that weight. And he's coming off 2 wins. He's got this win over Zach McCoskey, who's looked really good. A win over Scott Jorgensen, who hasn't looked as good as he did previously a few years back. But he has lost to Benavidez, and he has lost to John Dodson. So he has those 2 losses in the division. And, you know, winning 3 out of your last 5 doesn't sound too bad. But I just don't see him getting a shot at Demetrius Johnson right now. And I'm not sure if he's scheduled for another fight and it would push him over the edge or not. But, you know, it seemed to me like Dodson will probably get the next shot.
And then the other big headache in that division, a guy that you could probably groom for a title fight, John Lineker, continually missed weight. I mean, I don't know how many times he's missed weight, but it's got to be at least four times. You know, he's a guy who beat Ian McCall. He beat pretty much everybody they've thrown at him in the UFC except Bagatinov, who, you know, all this, you know, that doesn't look like a, you know, maybe he was all gimmicked up like he was against Mighty Mouse. So maybe, maybe that loss can be excused, but he can't make the weight. So how do you trust this guy?
Yeah, you can't. That's a problem. You know, the fight with Ian McCall was supposed to be a number one contenders fight, but, you know, the guy doesn't make weight. So what do you do in that situation? Do you reward someone for screwing up, or, you know, do you, you know, you gotta punish him somehow. You can't give that guy a title fight.
And what's crazy about it, Tom, is he doesn't just miss weight. That fight against McCall, he came in at 130. 130. That's five over. Or, well, four, because of the one-pound allowance. And then the other two times he didn't make weight, 128 and 129. I mean, it seems like he doesn't even try.
Yeah. Well, hey, you know, you've heard the term going ham. Well, maybe John Lineker is going ham before the weigh-ins, you know, for a month or two and, you know, just stuffing it down his throat. Who knows?
Yeah, but, you know, getting back to Mighty Mouse, I mean, I really hate to, you know, not talk him up because, I mean, you defend your title six times in this sport. I mean, that is so hard to do. And really nobody has been all that competitive with him. But I think it's just this prejudice of seeing these miniature grown men run around in a cage. It just kind of looks weird to people. And so I think there's a prejudice there. And the other issue is, and it's documented, I have this book by Reed Kuhn called Fightnomics. The knockout percentage at 125 pounds is like, you know, I don't want to throw any numbers because I can't remember the numbers, but it's significantly less than, say, welterweight.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a great book, by the way. I'm glad you mentioned it because Reed, first of all, I've spoken to him, I've met him, he's a great guy. But that book, really, if you're a coach or you're a fighter, that is a book that you should be buying. You should be on Kindle. You should be buying Fightnomics. You should be researching all the statistics that are in there. It gives a lot of great breakdowns, and you can draw a lot of inferences from these statistics if you're a fighter or a corner man. So we'll get that plug in there, man. Read Fightnomics, great book. You can find it on Kindle or on Amazon, whatever you want. And yeah, like you said, the finishing rate is just not as high. And it's just, it'll never be as high, I don't think, you know. My stance on this, and I might catch some backlash for it, but here's my thought, Brian, is if you're in an MMA promotion and there's a woman at your weight class who's a champion, then you should move up a weight. There shouldn't be a men's champion if there's a woman's champion at that weight. That's my thought process.
You're going to draw some heat. You know, I was on MMA Fighting or MMA Junkie, and between the, 18 articles about Jon Jones, there was something in there that ONE FC is starting a male strawweight division. Did you read that?
Yeah, so it's Bellator. Bellator is having fights at the 115 division coming up.
I mean, I could see ONE FC because, you know, not to get too, like, racial-like, but to find grown men at that weight, you have to go to Asia or you have to go to South America. So it would make sense to me that ONE FC is doing that because seeing somebody fight 115 pounds, you know, in Asia, I mean, that's not really a big deal. You know, they're just statistically, they're smaller people. I mean, that's not an insult. That's just, you can look that up. It's simple sociology, you know, but I don't know. I mean, if you're going to try to promote
what?
100 and
sociology,
what is it? Statistical data?
Well, I don't think it's sociology. I think it's physical data.
All right. Well, whatever. All right. I was struggling to make my point anyway. And then you interrupt me. What was my point going to be? Oh, I don't know how an American promotion can promote 115-pound male fights.
I think a simple rebranding of it, maybe as the mini division, would help. You could throw one of these guys into an El Torito costume, or what are the other Mascarita de Grata? Mascarita de Grata, is that it?
You know, when I was at that WrestleMania after party, I wanted a mark out so bad for El Torito, but I had to kind of act like, I kind of belong here, so I wasn't I wasn't bothering any of the guys, for pictures or anything. But I was like, oh man, out of all these guys, I want to meet El Torito.
Yeah, I would go with my favorites would probably be El Torito and Hornswoggle, based on did you see the WLC match last year? It was actually last year's Extreme Rules pay per view.
Yes, I actually do remember that, it was really entertaining. Now that you mentioned it, I'm going to check that out and relive it.
But yeah, everybody should.
Yeah, from a comedic point of view, hey man, give those guys credit. I mean, those guys are working hard.
Yeah, that match was great. So that right there is proof that guys that size can draw and get people interested in their matches. Demetrius Johnson's a great fighter. I just don't really feel that compelled to watch him, unfortunately. I felt even less compelled to watch the co-main event on this show between your boy Candy Maldonado and Rampage. So,
it's like one of those things, but Rampage is like a necessary evil because the UFC, they're running out of recognizable names. And my dad asked me, he doesn't really watch it. He sees the highlights on ESPN SportsCenter. And he said, well, who's fighting tonight? I saw there's some fights on. And I immediately said, Rampage Jackson. He's like, oh, yeah? Oh, okay. And I didn't mention anything else. I didn't tell him the main event. I said Rampage Jackson. And so, I mean, the point being, this guy's name has value, even though he's not entertaining at all to watch. And he's annoying because he's always bitching about something. And apparently it's not an act because he really does screw over these promotions and just, leaves and says terrible things about them. After they pay him more money than they were contractually obligated to pay him.
Yeah, that whole situation is ridiculous to me. I don't know what legs Rampage has to stand on when this lawsuit, goes down. One thing, and this was brought up, on Wrestling Observer, which I know you listen to.
I actually wanted to plug that Tom has a new perhaps regular gig now with the legendary Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez on WrestlingObserver.com. So is that going to be every Saturday now?
No. I don't believe so. And I'm sure, I'll let them make an announcement if there's any announcement to make because I don't have all the facts, Brian, but I don't think it'll be every Saturday. Maybe when there's UFC is coming up, I'll be on Saturdays, but I don't know exactly what the situation is there. But I was on Saturday, and Dave brought up a great point, and that was that during the deliberations for the injunction, or whatever the case is, the judge said he didn't think that letting Rampage fight would do any harm, any irreparable damage to Bellator. And then in the lead up to the fight, during his post fight interview, all he's talking about is how shitty Bellator is, and to me that is kind of irreparable damage. The guy goes from one platform to another. Obviously this story's been in the media. People know why he wasn't able to fight and why he wasn't scheduled to fight and how it all went down. And then the guy gets on TV and just basically runs down Bellator and says how much better the UFC is than Bellator. So you take that into account. Also look at it from the standpoint of the UFC supposedly has decided to go to, some sort of mediation regarding all these lawsuits that they've been hit with. And you know, a lot of this stuff goes back to antitrust laws and issues. And if Bellator is being run down by UFC fighters and being called a second-rate organization, I'm not sure that's exactly the best strategy when it comes to hammering out these lawsuits and getting everything handled for the UFC. So, you know, I honestly, I think I understand why the UFC brought Rampage back. I don't know about the timing of it, but it's a good name for them to have. If you look at some of the other guys they've been having fighting recently, you know, they brought back Krokop. That's another big name that people are interested in seeing fight, even if he's not fighting for the title. And, you know, I think you'll continue to see them kind of build shows, maybe some of the smaller shows around veterans in that vein, Krokop, Rampage, some of these guys that have a name from a past generation.
You know, Tom, just to touch upon the judge in the Bellator UFC legal thing. Well, actually, it's not Bellator suing UFC. They're not suing the UFC. They're suing Rampage. But for a judge to sit up there and say that taking away Rampage from Bellator does no harm to Bellator, he's the only guy on their roster who can draw 2 million viewers on Spike. So you take him away. I mean, that was the reason. There were two main reasons to bring Rampage back to the UFC. Number one, he's a name, and he's a marginal draw at this point, but marginal is better than bad. And then I think the other one was you took away a guy from Bellator who was their top draw. Now it's probably Kimbo. I mean, as funny as that sounds, or Tito, but they just took away a chess piece from Bellator, and it's not like these guys are growing on trees. So how does that not hurt Bellator's ability to compete in the marketplace?
Oh, I mean, for sure it does, but you know, I think the issue, and just based on what the wording of what the judge said, was that, you know, it doesn't cause irreparable damage. It's not like Bellator's gonna go by the wayside because Rampage fought in this UFC. But to me, it sure as shit doesn't look good when the guy's out there running him down. And the basis for him fighting was that it wasn't going to harm Bellator in any way, you know? And it could be a case when it comes right down to it that this could be Rampage's only UFC fight during this term where this lawsuit's going on. He might be forced to go back to Bellator or have some sort of settlement with him. So who knows in the future? This could come back to maybe even hurt Quentin in the long run.
Yeah, well, it's good that you pointed that out because it's definitely not over. That ruling was just for that specific fight. We really haven't even started the war here between Bellator and Rampage. But, you know, you brought up there, and I don't know if you were getting at it, but this was something I was thinking about. If Rampage is going to fight in the UFC again, I would like to see him fight Krokop. Fight him in heavyweight.
Yeah, hell yeah. I think that's the best way to go to me. I mean, that's a fight that I would love to see. It's a fight that's never happened before, and it could headline a show, you know, for sure. And it could headline more than a Fight Pass show to me. You could throw that show easily on Fox Sports 1, and that fight could take place anywhere. You know, it could take place in Europe. It could take place in the U.S. Doesn't matter. Maybe Rampage doesn't want that. Maybe he wants to fight on a pay-per-view, so we can get some pay-per-view money from the UFC or pay-per-view buys. I don't know what the situation with his contract is, but if I'm booking the UFC, I'm fucking throwing him in there versus Krokop for sure. I can't think of another fight that makes more sense for either one of those guys.
Yeah, I know there's... Go ahead.
Did you see the kicks from Rampage? He's ready. He's ready to kickbox against Krokop.
Well, the other one that people are talking about is Rampage versus Rashad too, which, you know, the first fight, let's be serious, it was very boring, but it was one of the best builds to an MMA fight, I would say, in history. I mean, it did over 1 million pay-per-view buys. So it was a great build, and then Rashad went out there and fought this highly technical style, and... You know, we were kind of left like, that wasn't too interesting. And so now that they've kind of, they're not at each other's throats anymore, I mean, why do we want to see that?
Yeah, I don't know. It's not exactly a fight that I want to see. You know, all these fights that Rampage ends up losing that are, you know, these kind of decisions, it's not like I've ever wanted to see another one again. Rampage versus Machida. Don't really want to see that fight again. Rampage versus Rashad. Don't want to see that one. As a matter of fact, I left during that fight at a UFC. I left. I went to the airport and left while that fight was on.
UFC 114, right?
Yeah, that was I believe that was the one. I was in Vegas. I had a late night flight, so that's why I left. I would have stayed for that fight. I'm just I'm just using that to further my point, even though it doesn't help.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
You know, I think Rampage versus Krokop's the way to go. You know, I'm sure Rampage doesn't care if he's fighting at heavyweight against somebody as long as he's making money. And he's not going to be fighting for the title anytime soon. So I say you put him in there with another guy who's got a decent name, get some money out of it, put him at the top of the card, and then stack that undercard with, you know, local up and comers. You know, if it's in a good market, or you throw underneath a good headliner and reap the benefits that way.
Sure. And also on that card, UFC 186 last Saturday was probably of the fights that I watched. I didn't watch them all, but I enjoyed Bisping and Dalloway the most because, you know, Bisping, he doesn't look like he should still be competing. You know, I don't know. Maybe the guy memorized the eye chart and that's how he passes those tests. Because I kind of see that like half serious. So I'm not sure. He's one of these guys that just seems to be that next grade of toughness. You know, there's UFC fighter tough, and then Bisping's that notch above. And I was watching that first round. You know, Bisping's about 35 years old, and I'm like, yeah, I think that's about it. I think we've seen, you know, guys get old in one night in combative sports, and I thought that's what we were watching, right? And then he comes storming back and wins the last two rounds decisively and takes a decision.
Yeah, I thought that was definitely the fight of the night. And I watched all the fights except for the fight pass fights. So when I saw the fact that Laprise and Barbarena got the fight of the night, I was a bit taken aback, you know, because I thought Bisping versus Dalloway was by far the best fight that I had seen the entire night. Bisping, like you said, he ate a big left hook and got dropped in that first round. And that was a round that CB definitely took. And it looks like he took that round on all the judges' scorecards. But Bisping was able, to his credit, he kind of got back up, reversed the position a little bit. He had great defense on the ground too. CB knocks him down and then tries to punch him from on top. And man, I can't tell you if one of those shots really connected. Bisping had a great – it was kind of like almost like a De La Hiva or open guard, and was able to keep Dalloway away and get back up to his feet. And he actually put a little bit of pressure on CB as that round ended. And then the second or third rounds were pretty much every way you see Bisping win a fight. You know, he just kind of outgassed CB, and you could tell CB was slowing down. He was still trying his hardest and still hitting some good left hooks. But – you know, Bisping was just too much and took over from there, and then, you know, basically gave the best babyface promo that I've seen all year after the fight. And it's crazy. You know, if you look back a few years ago, Bisping was hated. Everybody hated this guy. And then lo and behold, you know, the guy's on Fox all the time. I was at the last fight that he had where he lost to Luke Rockhold in Australia. And let me tell you, if there was a crowd favorite there that night, it was Bisping. It was not Rockhold. It's another instance where this guy – go ahead.
I think you're right. I think the Fox gig has kind of softened his image a little bit, you know, and people see that he's a nice guy, which he is.
Yeah. And another thing, I mean, the guy's coming back from like – basically he's got one eye, right? He's got one eye. He's out there fighting. He wins the fight because basically he has more heart – than the guys that he's fighting. And then he gives this great babyface promo about, you know, he's getting towards the end of his career. He's getting old, but he's still going to go out there and do it. He deserves that title shot. He still wants it, and he's going to get it. And damn it, happy birthday to my son, because it's his birthday today too. and I won that fight. I just thought, you know, he came across as definitely a star, which everybody knows he is, but, you know, a really, really likable guy after that fight.
Did he ever say his son's name? Because I think his son follows me on Twitter. I wasn't sure if that was his.
His son's name is Callum.
Okay, so that is him. He does follow me on Twitter. Okay, that's him.
And he's a kind of a regular on the UG as well. I think the word was he just Goldberg said this during the fight was he just took second at a grappling tournament not too recently. So perhaps we'll see him following his father's footsteps. Congrats to him for getting, you know, competing and getting out there. And I'm sure he's got a bullseye on his back, being the son of Michael Bisping, but more power to him. And hey, happy birthday.
For sure. Who do you see as a next opponent for Bisping? I'm seeing a couple things, just throw out a couple ideas. Lyoto Machida, winner of Gegard Mousasi and Costas Philippou.
Maybe Bisping versus Mousasi. I would expect Mousasi to beat Philippou. That fight would make sense to me. And past that, I don't know. He's in a tough situation because he's a big name guy, right? So you don't want to put him in there against a no name prospect and risk it. But at the same time, you know, he's already had these number one contender fights where he's lost across the board. So I don't know how long you can keep pushing him back up to the top, but I think he made as good a case for any and definitely got the fans behind him wanting to see him fight again in the future. So I thought he looked great. I thought he did a great job. He was probably he probably had the best overall performance when you take into account the fight and the after fight promo. So
yeah, I'm looking here on MMA Junkie. Mike Bond, writer for MMA Junkie, suggested that Bisping fight Jacare next, since, you know, it looks like Rockhold's going to get the title shot.
Yeah, and that's one I think would be a good fight, actually. I think it's pretty low risk for the most part for Jacare. I would expect Jacare to blitz him and catch him with a punch or maybe even a submission somewhere along the line. But hell, if Bisping wins, there's your story right there. So I think that's a great idea because realistically, I do think Rockhold should get that next title shot just based on how, you know, the momentum he had coming off of Fox, that Fox show. So hell yeah, let's see Bisping versus Jacare. Let's get a card with Bisping versus Jacare. We can get Rampage versus Crow Cop on that same show, and maybe we can get Demetrius Johnson versus El Torito.
Well, how about Michael Bisping versus CM Punk?
Oh God! All right, so John McDessie versus Shane Campbell was another fight there. You can tell how much I want to touch on that CM Punk situation.
You're not a CM Punk guy?
Not necessarily.
So what? Whoa, there's got to be a story to this because you're in that pro wrestling world. Was there some heat with Punk at some point, or?
No, none at all. Absolutely none. The thing that bothers me about that situation is, if you look at the comments he made about the WWE, the guy's a fucking hypocrite because he's going to come in and take somebody's spot, somebody that's been working hard to be in the UFC. And it's coming from somebody who outright, you know, basically said that The Rock shouldn't have, come back right in and stolen the spotlight from guys who have been around the whole time. So to me, you know, it's the same situation. It's just that now that he's the perpetrator in it instead of somebody else from the outside. So that's really the biggest issue that I have with it there.
Yeah, he's really good at saying really stupid shit. And I think he's going to end up paying for what he said about the WWE doctor because the allegations he made against that doctor, I mean, I would assume that could get you hauled in front of some kind of medical board hearing to...
I believe he's being sued by that...
Yeah, he is suing CM Punk, yeah. Which, yeah. I mean, if CM Punk is bullshitting about this doctor, I mean, as a physician, I mean, the only thing you got is your reputation. And if this guy is going on some podcast that's seen, you know, hundreds of thousands of people listen to and says you know, for MRSA, gave him a Z-Pack and a pat on the back or something, I'm like, wow, that's quite an allegation.
Yeah, yeah. It's a serious one, especially when you're dealing with a medical professional. And that stuff's no joke, man. You know, making a comment like that could really screw somebody over in the future. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. And, you know, until we see CM Punk get a fight booked and see that he's ready to go, it's all pretty much just up in the air until then. But, I mean, I have no personal experience with them. It's just that in that situation, you know, I feel that he's being very hypocritical. And damn it, Brian, it bothers me.
Hey, how about this guy, Almeida? Is he for real? He's 18-0. He's a young guy. Is he the next big thing?
No way. You think Paul Heyman's going to come out and endorse Thomas Almeida? He's not the next big thing. He's a tough fighter. Great. But you can see, I mean, he got taken down by Yves Jabouin kind of early, right off the bat. And I can't tell you the last time Yves Jabouin, you know, out wrestled somebody in a fight that I saw. So that kind of caught me off guard, but he did recover. He did get a big TKO. But yeah, I don't know if he's a world beater, but he's definitely somebody to keep an eye on. And the most interesting thing to me about it all is that he's coming from Shootabox. This is like the reemergence of Shootabox on the scene, which would kind of be, you know, maybe a welcome addition. In my book, it's always cool to see, you know, one of these old school teams kind of still putting guys out. I mean, how awesome would it be if Hammer House put somebody out right now? Or we get Lion's Den 2K15. How great would that be?
Team Quest.
Well, Team Quest is still around in one form or another. So it wouldn't be they'd be more like, you know, Shootabox putting guys out there than they would be Hammer House or Lion's Den. Or even what about Team Jesus Is Lord? Do you remember them?
No, who was that?
Oh, that was like it was a big Hawaiian team back in the day. They had fighters on Super Brawl. They had guys in the UFC. Do you remember the name Ron? I think it was Ron Jun, Stun Gun. I don't know if he was in the UFC, but he was a decent name back in the early days of MMA. And there was the guy Felinico Vitali. That's the guy that.
He fought
Matt Lindland knocked himself out.
With. Yeah, that's.
Yeah, Matt Lindland tried to throw him and knocked himself out, and I think he was from that same team. So those are some of my favorite old school fight teams. And we talked about Jabouin's fight, and then right after that we had Fear the Fighter himself, John McDessie, facing off against late replacement Shane Campbell. And basically, McDessie weathered a little bit of an early storm, hit him with a big right, swarmed him until the ref, you know, decided Campbell was taking too much of a beating. And I was really hoping that McDessie would call out Gegard Mousasi and everybody else that's suing him right after the fight, but he did no such thing.
Yeah, what have you heard about that Fear the Fighter thing? I mean, I know Gegard Mousasi is going to sue them or is suing them, and McDessie is listed as the president of the company, but I heard that it's a figurehead thing, and it's really his brother that's a scumbag.
Yeah, from what I've – and obviously I'm not on the inside when it comes to these dealings. You know more about it than I do, really. But, yeah, I think McDessie's brother is the one running the show. But, hey, if you're involved with that situation and you know what's going on and guys aren't getting paid – it becomes an issue. So, you know, it must suck trying to get ready for a fight knowing that you got Gegard Mousasi wants a piece of you and is suing you, but McDessie still won the fight, and maybe he'll flip that money right around into another fighter's pocket. Or, you know, maybe he won't, and the people who signed those deals with Fear the Fighter are, you know, fearing getting paid.
I really wonder what was Fear the Fighter's business plan. I mean, there was a time there, like if there was 12 fights, you know, so that means 24 fighters, right? So they would be sponsoring about 20 of them. I mean,
yeah. Well, that seems to be the major business plan with most MMA apparel companies: is we're going to go out there, we're going to sponsor everybody under the roof, and that's how we're going to kick off our business. And you kind of saw it here. with this Tommy guy from Bud Light Living who's sponsoring everybody. I mean, what ulterior motive does Tommy have that he's out there sponsoring all these guys in the UFC?
What was that about? I mean, I was watching at a bar, so I didn't really get the commentary.
I think the UFC and Bud Light ran a promotion, and they had a winner, and it happened to be Tommy. So, UFC 186 was brought to you by Tommy from Bud Light Living.
So is he like now like a recurring character for Bud Light?
I don't know. I certainly hope not. The other thing is, you're going to have a Bud Light contest. Why the hell are you doing it in Canada? Why is that the fight? Shouldn't it, like, out of all the places, it should be in the U.S., you know? They don't even drink Bud Light in Montreal. They're drinking like Molson and shit like that.
Well, did you know Bud is not even an American company anymore?
Well, yeah, it's owned by whoever owns Stella Artois, the InBev Corporation.
Yeah, I think in Belgium.
Yeah. So, yeah, they're not even legit American. So go out there, guys, support Coors Light.
Yeah, Coors Light. They're Canadian, aren't they?
I don't know. What the fuck are you talking about? They're from Golden, Colorado, buddy.
No, but I think they were acquired by Molson.
Oh, don't ruin this for me, too.
Yeah, unfortunately, they're Canadian.
That's all hearsay.
But Canadians are better than Europeans.
Until we hear the update on the Coors Light situation from the Albuquerque police, I'm going to stay away. Anyways. There's something I want to touch on here, all right? Patrick Cote and Joe Riggs. I peruse the internet quite frequently, and I'm seeing a little bit of hatred coming out of the Joe Riggs side here and a possible allegation of some greasing going on. Riggs in his on his Facebook is talking about how Cote was real slippery. Riggs couldn't put his legs up his back. How he never lost back mount, but he just kind of slipped off, and it was like a slip and slide. So, very interesting comments coming out of there. I thought Cote looked really good in this fight, but maybe he was using the old Yoshihiro Akiyama strategy of oiling himself up or washing himself before the fight so he's slippery. I don't know what the deal is, but Cote took a decision there. And Joe Riggs, no pun intended, kind of shot himself in the leg in that first round by, giving up a takedown and letting Cote get on top. So, hey, props to Patrick Cote, because years ago I defeated Patrick Cote and put him out of the UFC, and he is, I would say, like 3.5 times improved compared to the time that I fought him. So congrats to him.
Yeah, he was infamously called the one-legged French Canadian by Chael, I think leading up to the first Anderson fight. You remember that?
Yeah.
He said, Anderson, you beat a math teacher, you beat a one-legged French Canadian.
Yeah.
And he thought that that Cote, took offense to it. So he saw Cote, he's like, hey man, you understand what's going on, right? And Cote just couldn't have been nicer. He was happy that he was mentioned.
Yeah. All my feelings with Cote, he's been really nice guy. I think he's even a little bit of a New England Patriots fan because he said that was like kind of the closest team to where he lives. So, I like Patrick Cote, and it's good to see he's kind of had a little bit of a career resurgence, added a lot of new skills. His ground game looks much improved, and his stand-up looks a lot more technical than even a few years ago. So as somebody who's starting to get a little long in the tooth, it's good to see these guys, these longtime veterans, still adding new tricks. It kind of gives me hope.
Yeah, how old is Cote at this point?
I think he's mid-30s. I don't really know.
That brings up Riggs. Riggs is 32 years old. I mean, he is the oldest 32-year-old that I've ever. I mean, he makes Carl Parisian look like a young guy. And oh man, he's got to find something else. He's got to. I don't know his skill set or what else he enjoys doing, but shit, man, at that weight, I mean, just his bone structure seems really off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just, I mean, guy's been in so many wars, and
yeah,
his body's been through so much. He used to be 300 pounds.
Yeah, he's got a lot of miles, and looks like maybe it's catching up to him. You know, the age thing to me isn't as big of an issue as what you've done, obviously, in that time period, because, you know, you get guys like Randy Couture entered the sport really late, and people make a huge deal about how he was fighting into his 40s, but he didn't start until he's in his 30s, you know. Then you get guys like Joe Riggs, who started real young, or Carol Pugin, or Nick Diaz, guys like that, who started real young but have been around this entire time. And, you know, you kind of forget that these guys are still in their early 30s and are still plugging away. But, you know, sometimes it's not all equal. You know, obviously one person's 32 isn't equal to another one's, and it seems like Joe Riggs is kind of on the bad end of that 32. You know, although as far as guys like, you know, the Nogueira brothers.
Tom, what are you doing? Are you like juggling your computer and your headset, or what is going on over there?
I haven't moved, Brian.
Okay, then there's something wrong with my audio then.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways, let's touch on these other fights real quick, and then we can talk about some other stuff. But you know, we had Alexis Davis and Sarah Kaufman. Davis won by armbar first round after getting beat up by Sarah Kaufman. This was the third fight between them, and Sarah Kaufman had won the previous two and said, you know, she thought she was going to win this one and kind of maybe even end Alexis Davis's career.
Wow.
But yeah, but she got armbarred in that first round, and you know, she basically tapped for about 30 seconds before the ref saw it. And poor girl, maybe her arm's a little hurt today. And that ref should be reprimanded and possibly not used again.
What is that jabroni's name? Because it's not the first time he's fucked up.
He caused
Koscheck to look like he was in a scene from Brazzers.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what else to say about that one, but yeah, that ref sucks. So hopefully, you know, He picks it up and does better, or see you later. The fight before that was the fight of the night, although I wouldn't say it was the fight of the night. We already talked about Bisping and Dolloway. That was the best fight. Chad Laprise looked like he was the best guy in the world for the first 5 minutes, and then just kind of get tired. I think he won 30-27 on one judge's scorecard, which is a terrible, terrible score, because he did nothing in the third, and he went 29-28 in the other. So he got a unanimous decision. He gets the fight of the night bonus along with Brian Barberena. So those guys should thank their lucky stars and should probably be sending some of that money to CB and Bisping.
Now, are you referring to CB Dolloway or CB Dillashaw as Super Callow?
CB Dolloway, the Doberman.
Now, do you follow Super Callow, Tom?
Yeah, of course I do.
Okay. I was just making sure.
Yeah, sometimes I hire him to come over and do my dishes. He's got a lot of experience in that realm.
Well, you know, he just changed his avatar or whatever you call it on Twitter. He's now an attorney because he's offering his services pro bono to John Jones.
Oh, my God.
Apparently he's also an attorney.
Yeah.
Who am I to question him?
I don't know. Well, at least he's offering those services pro bono. And, you know, I'd be more concerned if he was offering his service Chaz Bono.
Oh, God. Oh, so, man.
Yeah. We could touch on that subject, too. We could touch on the big Bruce Jenner interview the other night if you wanted.
That's all right.
Okay. And the last fight that I saw from this show, and I'm going to recycle the joke I used on The Observer, but was between Olivier Aubin-Mercier and David Machaud, who, you know, out of these two guys, they look very similar. They both kind of look like Jonas Brothers, long hair. But Machaud first of all, had like a huge head. His head was like twice the size of Aubin Mercier's. And at some point he got caught in the mouth and he looked like my boy Steve Borden, Sting, trying to look like the Joker as he did in TNA. So that's how I was able to tell these two guys apart for most of the fight. Mashaud, you know, other than a big knockdown in the second round, didn't show very much. And Aubin Mercier was basically, he has some of the best like back control in the world, or Mashaud has some of the worst back defense, because the majority of this fight was spent with Aubin Mercier on Mashaud's back like he was a koala bear. So Aubin Mercier ended up getting the tap via the Dan Severn style rear naked choke in the third round. And, you know, he looked good as a possible, you know, Canadian fringe star. You know, the people are behind him. It's good for him to fight in Montreal and Quebec. And, you know, I think he's a guy that the fans really like, and he's got a good look. And he could be, you know, he could be something for the Canadian fans. Maybe not a title challenger, but somebody that they could kind of get behind.
Is he as good as, say, Sylvain Grenier?
No. Well, I mean, it's different. Yeah, he's better than him for sure, but I don't know if he'll get the same opportunities that Sylvain did, because there's no one, I don't think, in the UFC front office. That's
I know where you're going with that. You know, you know, here's another sidebar kind of funny story. So I'm in St. Louis at the NCAA Wrestling Championships, and I've been drinking all day, and Jerry Briscoe's had a few himself. So I of course, go for the kill and say, "Hey, Jerry, can you tell us some stories about Pat Patterson and some of the boys?" And he's like, "Well, I've never seen him act unprofessionally to anybody."
He's never seen it.
The way he phrased it, it was like, yeah. "Well, I've never seen him act unprofessionally." He got so serious. Yeah. So was Grenier was one of Pat Patterson's like pet projects?
Hey, Brian, you're the insider. I'm not hanging out backstage at WWE WrestleMania events. I was paying $300 to sit in the crowd like a peon. So why don't you tell me?
Well, I don't know much about pro wrestling behind, you know, I watch it as a complete mark. You know, I try not to be smartened up, not to know like what's going on, because it's easier to suspend my disbelief and I can enjoy it more.
Yeah. That's kind of how I do it with mixed martial arts. So we do the same thing. That's for opposite sports. You know, so it was good to see, like we're talking about, a lot of face turns on the show. Bisping had a big face turn. Rampage kind of went corporate Rampage. Maybe, you know, maybe we'll see him coming out with Dana as his bodyguard soon. Who knows? And it was a good show. Not a lot of news coming out of it, but hell, not every UFC can be the best one ever. So congrats to all the winners. And if you lost, well, it happened. So
yeah, you know, fuck off if you lost, you know. Oh, don't man. Whine about it, right?
Jeez, come on. Hey, if I would have fought in this show, I would have lost. I'd be 0-3 in Montreal. You know, so.
Well, you know, you actually broke a little bit of news on the Wrestling Observer show about you fighting. You want to share that with people?
Well, I mean, there's not a whole lot of news. I've just basically been told to be ready for, you know, July. So I've started getting myself into, you know, a little bit of – I've started to get into shape. I was already trying to get into shape because the pool season here in Las Vegas has kind of started to cut my carbs and hit the tanning salon and, you know, get a good pump every once in a while. And hopefully I can just kind of parlay that into the fight camp and keep things going. So look for me this summer. And if it's not in the cage, it'll be in your pool.
So it's going to be in July. So that could mean Vegas, San Diego, Scotland,
yeah,
and Chicago,
yeah,
right?
It could also be after that. Basically, I was told, you know, July or around that time period. And that was in, you know, no small part thanks to you, Brian. So I said before, thanks again.
Yeah, that was actually nice of Joe Silva, because I was in New Jersey at the event, and Joe was there, and we were talking, and I had this bright idea to, hey Joe, when's Tom gonna fight? He's looking for a fight. And he's like, oh, whenever he wants one. I was like, well, can we call him up now? He's like, sure, I'll talk to him. It's kind of funny how that happened. But so do you have anything else about 186 that you wanted to mention?
No, not at all. Like I said, there's not a whole lot of news coming out of that show. Most of the stuff that's been going on has been, outside of that realm. So, yeah, I've touched on pretty much everything from UFC 186. And it's my second time doing so. So I'm kind of running out of things to say.
Yeah. You know, a pretty important thing is coming up on May 11th, Tuesday. I believe that's a Tuesday in Las Vegas. It's a Nevada commission is having a hearing regarding Wanderlei Silva. And Wanderlei Silva, no, actually, I don't even think this is a commission thing. Like, this is like a real court. And they're going to put out an opinion if the commission had the right to test Wanderlei Silva. Of course, he ran from the test, but did they have the right to ask for a specimen from Wanderlei when he was an unlicensed combatant in the state of Nevada at the time? This is last May. And this is a story, which I read in The Observer, that is flying under the radar, which I think it's going to be used as precedent going forward. Nevada have the right?
Go ahead. Brian, yeah, I was just going to say, this is one of those things like, this is a big deal. I mean, this is a huge deal if you're a fighter, because we're going to find out, did the NAC act pretty much against their own rules, against the law, and are they trying to punish somebody for something they had no right to do? So, I mean, I guess conceivably we could get a Wanderlei return, right? Even though he's badmouthed pretty much everything to do with the UFC to this point.
Yeah, but, Wanderlei can make them money. So I think all would be forgiven as long as they can get him through the licensing process. I'd throw Wanderlei out there against, there's any number of people. How about Michael Bisping, rematch of their fight in Australia from about 5 years ago? Or any number of fights.
You could get you could have a rematch with Rampage. Would that be a fourth fight? I mean, I'd still watch it. I mean, I'd rather see those guys against, other veterans or other legends. I think those fights are more exciting to me than, seeing Rampage get taken down by Pat Cummins for three rounds, or, seeing Wanderlei fight somebody who's going to take him to the ground and just beat him.
And you want to see the legends of the sport fight somebody who's about at their skill level. I mean, why throw these guys who are clearly past their prime to the wolves? I don't want to see Shogun get beat up again. I don't want to see Wanderlei get beat up again. I mean, I don't care about Krokop. I don't want to see Nogueira get beat up. Put these guys against, other guys who are, maybe kind of washed up themselves.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Kind of like I don't mind the Ken Shamrock Kimbo fight, because it's, it's clear what Bellator is doing. It's kind of a freak show fight. And as long as they don't, bog down the entire card with fights like that, they hold a purpose, and it's a pretty damn good one, because it's going to bring viewers in. The fighters on the undercard will have more eyes watching them, so it's a great promotional strategy. And obviously, like we're talking about, you could do the same thing with Wanderlei. He could headline any number of shows. He could headline in. He could headline in Japan. He could cross the globe and do pretty well for himself. So, I hope it's not the end of his career that we've seen so far. And I guess we just have to kind of sit and wait and see what happens on May 11th.
Yeah, and I hope it's not one of those bullshit, like, continuance and Well, you know, I'm sure this is going to drag out because the state of Nevada has endless resources and they will fight this to the bitter death. So I don't know if this is a final opinion or if then it'll go to a higher court, or hopefully it's enough to get them reinstated, because it sounds so ridiculous that a sanctioning body can ban you forever. Forever? What? And what do you mean forever? He didn't murder anybody.
Well, he is the axe murderer, Brian. So, you know, I can neither, much like the Albuquerque police, I can neither confirm nor deny if Vanderlei Silva has ever killed anybody. So, you know, to say he's not a murderer, I don't know for sure. I don't know that he has, but his nickname is the axe murderer.
I hear you on that. My point is just that I hate to see a government agency taking it upon themselves to act as God and say, no, you can't make a living, because they know the UFC will not defy them and book him in another location. And the UFC will not release him from his promotional agreement. So even though Vanderlei retired, allegedly, it was a forced retirement. They've made this guy not be able to make a living. That's illegal. This judge has got to side with Vanderlei on this.
I would think that they do, simply because of the fact that he wasn't licensed. I think if he was licensed, that they have virtually every right to suspend him for running from that test. But, I mean, he did – it's tough. I guess he technically hadn't signed for the fight. Right, or he hadn't at least applied for the.
There was no fight contract. Chael had signed his side of the contract, but Vanderlei had not signed his.
Yeah, so I don't see how you can punish somebody in that situation. I just don't see how you can. It's basically like punishing somebody for something that they never had any intention of doing. You know,
They're saying that. Because it was announced, and because the day before Vanderlei ran out on the test, there was a press conference. And they used this same argument of how they were able to test, I believe it was the guys at UFC 146, when the whole card was heavyweight, and they tested everybody, and they got over him, who was unlicensed. Yep. Now, he had just fought Lesnar, but that was a conditional license that expired right after the fight, or it was either after the fight or 2 days later on January 1st of 2012. So they said that just because it was announced, now we can test you. I mean, that was the Kaiser administration. This thing with Vanderlei happened under Kaiser too, right? When did he?
No, I don't know if it happened, yeah, it must have been under – I believe it was under him. I'm getting some of the things mixed up. There's been a big turnaround with the CSAC since they've been overtaken by – I believe Andy Turner is the guy's name. And they kind of like flipped their script and have been doing a lot of testing since then. And previously they weren't really known for it. But I don't remember the exact time that Kaiser took off from the NAC. In comparison to when that test went down, because it has been a while. It's been about a year almost since that test happened.
It was
feels like it, because Vanderlei and Chael were supposed to fight last summer.
It was the press conference before Memorial Day card 2014. So like 2 days before UFC 174, Barrow,
yes,
Dillashaw.
Yeah, so we're looking at about a year. It's been about a year since then. So, you know, this has already been dragging on for a while.
I mean, at what point is enough punishment enough? I mean, everybody knows how I feel about Chael being suspended for 2 years. I mean, I don't know why he was suspended for 2 years. I mean, they're like, oh, because he tested positive in California. Well, no, actually, that suspension was shortened to 6 months because they said it was a disclosure issue and not an issue of trying to deceive anybody. He told George Dodd he was on the stuff, the former commissioner in California. So it's like, well, why did he get 2 years? Just because it was growth? So, I mean, these government agencies, man, dealing themselves into private enterprise that they really have. What interest of the public? Why is it of the public's interest, or representatives of the public, which the government is, or government figures, why should they be involved in two people fighting in a cage for a private company?
I mean, how deep? I don't have that much time if we want to go really deep into this.
We've already done enough, but
into this talk. But I mean, as far as a fighter, from my fighter's perspective, I'm glad that they are, because I'm not using anything. And, you know, there's virtually no way to stop people from doing it unless somebody takes control. And whether it's the UFC, who basically they claim that they don't have the jurisdiction to do so, and they claim that the commissions do. And I'm okay with that. You know, if the commissions are getting paid from the promotions and they exist in order to turn some sort of profit and continue to operate – well, then they should be doing their part. You know, they're not just they shouldn't just be a governing body that's sitting there and not necessarily, you know, doing anything except collecting money and sending officials to the fights. There's a lot of other stuff that could go on leading up to the fight, and I believe that they should be involved and they should be testing the fighters.
You know, Tom, I mean, I disagree with you on that, because I look at a sport like NASCAR that self-governs. And driving around in a circle at 225 miles an hour is probably more dangerous than fighting somebody. You know, there's not any state commissions that oversee stock car racing. Why are they involved in boxing and MMA? Because, you know, usually the response is because it's so dangerous. The government would need to provide oversight to protect us. Well, how about all the other dangerous shit that's allowed? Like I said, well, racing.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's look at the history of these sports. Basically, mixed martial arts kind of piggybacked off of the boxing model, right? So boxing's been a cash grab for cities, for commissions throughout history. So right there, to me, that's right off the bat, that's why there's differences between NASCAR and that sort of thing. NASCAR's only been around for, you know, a shorter time and been less on the radar as far as a major league sport goes, compared to how prize fighting has been throughout history. So, you know, you could go back all the way to fights like Jack Johnson in the early 1900s, and you had various cities lobbying to get him to fight there, or, you know, maybe not even him, but, you know, you have white heavyweight champions at the time, and cities were trying to get fights with these world heavyweight champions. So, throughout history, there's always been, you know, state commissions or municipalities or, you know, the state governments or national governments have been getting involved in these things. So as far as the UFC goes and fighting, you know, I have no issues with it there at all.
All right. Well, you guys know my take on it, a kind of a more libertarian type stance. I don't know where Tom stands politically, but that's from his perspective as an actual combatant. And we've talked here for, I don't know, a good hour and 20 here. We covered a bunch of shit. So, oh yeah, the counter move. We're going to have some counter move news, or I'm supposed to get what it's supposed to be sent to me, what I'm supposed to tweet. I don't know exactly what I'm supposed to tweet, but Tom and I are going to have a game for Mayweather and Pacquiao. And I don't know how much it's going to be to get in. So that's why I need Adam, my manager, or my assistant, you know, producer, whatever he wants to call himself. I need him to send it to me so then I can send it out to the people, and then Tom can tell people too. So that's – I got to get the information on that.
Was that a passive-aggressive way of telling Adam to do it? Because that's what it sounded like to me. So
yeah, well, I mean, no, because usually I'm the one who stalls on him, and I don't do what I'm supposed to do. Like, usually that's me. So you know, he's got a couple things he's busy with. So because, you know, Tom, he's Kendra Lust said she'll come on the podcast. Do you know who that is?
I am somewhat familiar with her work.
I mean, we're talking A-list. I mean, it doesn't get any bigger in the adult film industry than Kendra Lust. What can we possibly even talk to her about?
Let's be honest. It does get bigger because you got guys like Mandingo and you got guys like Brian Pumper and some of these other guys. They're out there floating around and they're bigger in the adult industry.
Now, I wonder if they've ever shared the screen with Kendra.
Not sure, but we could do our research. Maybe it'll be on the Fight Finder on Sherdog.
Apparently, she's a big UFC and WWE fan. So that's Adam's other project to reach out to her public relations team. So hopefully we'll be talking to her because I can only speak for myself. I'm a big fan. I don't know if Tom is too. It sounds like somebody with a girlfriend.
I am. Like I said, you called it, nailed it on the head there.
All right. On that note, we'll cut it right there, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
There. Peace.